Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Before Baltimore was founded as a town in 1729, and long before it became a city, the port of Baltimore already existed. Last year marked record cargo levels for the port, almost 11 million tons of cargo, everything from cars and light trucks to wood pulp and equipment for farms, mining, and construction. Tomorrow, the Baltimore Museum of Industry and the Irish Railroad Workers Museum are hosting an event on the port's storied history, looking at the people who worked at and around the port, the cargo that passed through Baltimore, and the technological changes to shipping over the past 300 years. Joining me to preview the program is Jack Burkert, senior educator at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning, Sheila.
What is your goal for this talk you're giving?
Well, I'd love to make an entertaining and an informative presentation to folks. So at the museum, we've discovered that a lot of people come by and look out our window at the wonderful harbor view. And then we start talking about the port, and my goodness, what a wonderful place this is. What a wonderful story it is. And I thought, you know, we need to do a little bit more with this and become more informative. Entertaining, but informative nonetheless.
One of the first widely traded commodities to travel through the port was tobacco. Where was that crop headed?
That crop was headed to England. Most of it, anyway. One of the advantages to Baltimore's growth in the maritime business and port was, in fact, through the Revolutionary War period. There was a blockade imposed by the British on the East Coast, and interestingly enough, it was a little bit porous, if you will, at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. The gentlemen in England said, well, you can blockade those states, but don't blockade it too carefully at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, because that's where we get our tobacco from. And so as a result of that, a lot of the shipping that went out of the Chesapeake Bay, that is to say cargo from Baltimore, was able to slip through. Suddenly Baltimore became the port of choice in that in that time for shippers of all commodities, because they knew that they had a chance of getting their cargo through that blockade.
At some point, wheat also became a big crop, a big cargo through the Baltimore port. Was that before or after?
It was a little bit after. The port was formalized in the early 1700s. And along about that same time, a gentleman arrived from Ireland, of all places, thus our connection to the Irish Railroad Workers Museum. His name was John Stevenson. He was a doctor. And he spent his time working his way through the community up into Pennsylvania, Western Maryland, and meeting all sorts of folks for health reasons, as he was a doctor, obviously. But he noticed that they were just barely eking out a living in those communities. They were trying to grow tobacco. And you can imagine that the soils and climate in Frederick and Hagerstown and York, Pennsylvania, was not exactly the same as the tobacco farming country south of Baltimore. He noticed they were eking out this living, but he knew that there was a market ready for wheat in Ireland, his home. And he said, well, you know what you should do? You should grow wheat, and perhaps I'll buy it from you, put it on a ship, send it to Ireland, and sell it for you. And so that's exactly what he did. And he created commerce between Baltimore and Europe, many other places, with this wheat crop.
And wheat crops were also sold westward, right?
Well, it was coming from the west, and it was looking to get itself to markets through Baltimore. The wheat in the hinterlands, I guess, in those times, that was as far west, goodness knows, as perhaps Ohio, that kind of thing. They sent their wheat to market through Baltimore and other places, but of course the roads were terrible, and getting the product from that area to the port to go overseas was quite a challenge. Innovation took place in that period. In New York, the innovation was called the Erie Canal. That connected the hinterlands to a port, New York. This was tremendous competition for Baltimore, because Baltimore had had a reputation of being the place to send wheat from the Revolutionary War time. And so New York suddenly got into the game, if you will. They were going to have that wheat come over the Erie Canal, down the Hudson, and out to Europe and other places. The other competition that we had was New Orleans, because once you cross over the mountains, you've got the Ohio River feeding the Mississippi and all the way down to the Gulf Coast, and then you could put it on a ship from New Orleans. So Baltimore became quite challenged in all of this, between New York, New Orleans, that kind of thing. What did they do? Well, we couldn't build a canal because the geography just is not suited for a canal here. What we did was we built a railroad called the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. That was our link to the West.
And so the B&O Railroad was really sort of a partner with the port, not a competitor.
No, it was not a competitor. It was what made the port function. It was being able to bring product in from all over the West to Baltimore to be transported. Ellicott City was a major manufacturing center. I know now we go to restaurants and that sort of thing and look at suburban homes in Ellicott City, but in that period of time, it was a tremendous manufacturing, smelting, all of those kinds of places. That was the first terminus of the B&O. One always wonders, why would they stop there? What was the big deal about Ellicott City? It was a source of product to be shipped on the railroad to the port.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jack Burkert, senior educator at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. He'll be giving a talk at the museum this weekend on the 300-year history of the Port of Baltimore. Tell me something about who the workers were from the early days through the Civil War.
There were certainly a lot of folks involved in the port, and the first and most obvious one is the longshoremen, the people who do the lifting and toting of the product in and off the ships. There's a tremendous business community built up around the port to support it. We talk about all of the canvas making and that sort of thing in the Jones Falls Valley. That canvas was destined for a place, and it was the port. It was sail making. We had chandleries around to supply things to the ships. We had rope walks downtown Baltimore, on the west side of downtown, rope walks. When you make rope, you take strands of fiber and you lay them on the ground and you lay them on a long, narrow path, a quarter of a mile long. And you simply lay that strand and start walking, and you lay it down for a quarter mile, then you turn around and go get another strand. And you literally build a hawser, a heavy rope, one strand at a time. We had all sorts of other folks.
So between the activities that supported the port itself and the shipbuilding, and then the industries that shipped cargo through the port had a big impact on Baltimore's economy.
Oh, it was the economy. We had all sorts of products and services and that kind of thing going on, but we also had manufacturing. For example, John O'Donnell was an Irishman who got to Baltimore, became a maritime guy, quite wealthy, doing trade with China, bringing silks and teas and that kind of thing to Baltimore, part of that maritime the port history, bought a plantation on the east side of Baltimore. He called it Canton. He probably called it Canton because that was the area of China that he dealt with. We Americanized it, of course, instantly and became Canton. He passed away early. His son, Columbus O'Donnell, took over the plantation and turned it into an industrial park. That was the industrial heart of Baltimore for a long time. We know about Brewer's Hill, but we also need to know that there was a copper smelting operation over there, largest in the world at one time. That was a process of manufacturing something to then transship it right back out. So it was a tremendous operation impacting so many people.
I want to talk about a particular kind of cargo, the human cargoes, the human beings who were shipped through the ports, and particularly the slave trade.
Yes, there are a couple of things that went on here that are not as nice and positive as some of the things we've already talked about. We always had immigration. Immigration came into the port for many, many years. So we had 1.2 million people come in. But what people don't think about too much is the product of exporting people. We had exporting of slaves from Baltimore for many, many years. Probably from around 1810 to 1860, Baltimore was a transshipment point for slaves. Selling south was the term. The slaves in Baltimore, in Maryland and Virginia, there were enough slaves to serve the purposes of the masters in that particular point in time. But down south, something had changed. the cotton gin had been invented, which meant that cotton was becoming an even more of a major crop. But what they needed was field hands. They couldn't import slaves from overseas.
That was stopped by the federal government in 1808.
That's correct. And so the stopping of the slave trade into the country meant that they had to find slaves from somewhere else. Where would they get them? From the Mid-Atlantic region. And so what happened in Baltimore was slave pens were created on the west side of downtown, all along Pratt Street, slave pens, literally jails made of wood. And the slaves periodically were marched down Pratt Street all the way across town, past what now passes for Harbor Place and all that sort of thing, all the way to Fells Point, got on ships in chains, and were sold south. They sailed those slaves out of Baltimore to the deep south to become cotton field hands.
This was an incredible tragedy, both in terms of tearing families apart, but also the kind of work that awaited those slaves when they got to the cotton fields.
Indeed, there were 30,000 of them involved in that trade over that period of time.
But you mentioned immigration.
Indeed, indeed. And that, we have to go back to the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, because they were part of that process. What happened in Baltimore in the period, let's say 1840 to up until World War I, and particularly after the Civil War, we had immigrants coming to Baltimore regularly. After the Civil War, in the specific period, we had a steamship line, the North German Lloyd Steamship Company, sailed folks across the ocean to Baltimore. And from the piers in Locust Point, the folks got off of the boat and got on the train, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad passenger train, and traveled west into the Ohio Valley. I guess this is why you can go to Columbus, Ohio and find a German village, because that's certainly what was going on, was that folks literally were shipping themselves from the old country, from Central Europe, on the North German Lloyd steamship. They had bought a ticket not to Baltimore. They had bought a ticket to Columbus or Cincinnati. And they knew that when they got to Baltimore, they weren't going to be here very long. They were going to be here long enough to clear the health inspections and the customs and all that sort of thing, get on the train, and then travel westward through the mountains.
You argue the next big technological step for the port was the invention of the cargo container in the mid-20th century.
Boy, did it ever. It changed everything. If you go back and look at the old pictures, if you will, of cargo going on and off of vessels, you see literally hundreds of men standing around carrying packages and putting them into nets and hoisting them with cranes onto the ships, and then they would have to be unpacked from those nets. In 1956, a fellow by the name of Malcolm McLean, he owned a trucking company in North Carolina, decided that he maybe could figure out a better way of doing this. What he did was he said, well, wait a minute, suppose we just give the shipper a big box. We give them a big box, let them put everything in there, seal it up. We won't touch it except to carry the box. We carry the box on the ship. The box gets transported to the delivery point. The folks at the delivery point do the opening and closing and all that kind of thing. We don't have to touch the cargo anymore. We simply touch this big box. That big box that we look at today is a tractor trailer box, if you will. And there are literally thousands and thousands of them going through the port on a regular basis. The containerization had a human toll on the port. We had 10,000 longshoremen before containerization. Now we have about 2,000 longshoremen.
Even though there is so much cargo moving through the port, there are lots more advances I'd like to ask you about. We don't have the time. Let me just ask you as an historian, what do we learn from the port's history? What is the big lesson?
We learn that the city depends upon that port and that functioning heart, if you will, a transshipment point, a place where industry can thrive, where products come and go, where jobs are created, where jobs are maintained over time, always knowing that somebody like Malcolm McLean can upset our little apple cart and we'd better be on our toes for all that as well.
I'm looking forward to the talk you're going to give. Thank you for giving us a preview.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Jack Burkert is senior educator at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to this weekend's events on the port at the Baltimore Museum of Industry and the Irish Railroad Workers Museum. I'm Sheila Cass. Time for a quick break on the record and then a Stoop story. Mm. Mm.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.